This podcast is from the Overnights program on ABC Local Radio. I'm Tim Brunero. Gentrification is something that can cause emotions to rise and can be the topic of pretty intense debate. Some people see gentrification as a community good that turns crime-ridden slums into desirable locations. Others see it as a social evil. They say gentrification can force poor people out of the neighbourhoods they've lived in for years as rents increase beyond what they can afford. Despite what side of the fence you might sit on in this debate, gentrification has become a reality for many in most cities across Australia. Peter Kalizos is an author, an academic, who's been dubbed the property professor. He's a lecturer in property in the Faculty of Business at the University of South Australia. And he joins me now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Tim.
Define gentrification for us.
Gentrification can mean many things to many people, but a technical definition would be the process by which working-class residential neighbourhoods are rehabilitated by middle-class home buyers, landlords and professional developers. But there is a distinction because some people consider urban renewal as gentrification. So the difference is gentrification is basically turning old properties into new, whereas urban renewal is knocking down all the old properties and developing new properties, and they're often high-rise apartments.
Yes, that's an interesting distinction. So there's two things there. Gentrification, which is that thing we see in major cities where, as you say, wealthier, perhaps professional couples or middle-class people come into inner-city areas which they desire because of their geographic proximity to the CBDs. And they come in, they grab a property, they do it up, they renovate. They might even add a bit of a granny flat on the back or give it, you know, put some more space and time and money and love into it. And enough people do that and it changes the nature of the suburb. Whereas urban renewal is when what people kind of wholesale knock down big chunks of a suburb and stick up new blocks of units and completely change the sort of nature of it.
That's right. So probably a striking example would be in Melbourne, because these two areas are virtually next door to each other. One is Port Melbourne and the other one is the Docklands. So Port Melbourne, gentrification, they incorporated the existing buildings within the redevelopment of the area, whereas Docklands just up the road, old warehouses were knocked down and large high-rise buildings were put in their place. One, in my opinion, gentrification, areas that are gentrified have a soul, where people enjoy being there. There is a great sense of community, whereas the Docklands here we are 10 years after it was developed, and it's almost soulless.
Hmm. Would you mind giving us some examples in from each of the major metros in Australia? I know that's a bit of a tough one, but earlier the producer of this show, Marnie, was talking to me about this, and we were picking out some of the differences, different ones in Sydney, and it made it really clear to me because she said, look, Pyrmont is an example of urban renewal in Sydney, and say Surry Hills, Newtown, Darlington, Redfern are examples of gentrification here, and it might help if we kind of get some examples from all over Oz.
Yep. So, as you just mentioned, Sydney has some excellent examples, including Paddington and Balmain were areas of gentrification where old became new. Melbourne, I've mentioned Port Melbourne. Also, other suburbs going through gentrification in Melbourne include places like Brunswick, Coburg, Footscray, West Footscray. Adelaide, places going through gentrification include in the inner western suburbs of Torrensville, Theverton, Croydon, West Croydon. Brisbane, West End is a classic example of an area gone through gentrification. Historical homes close to the city. Blue-collar workers moved out, white-collar workers moved in. Perth is a tough one because there's not a lot of historical homes in Perth, but Victoria Park, East Victoria Park, is the best example I can come up with of an area that may have been industrial, had a lot of older style homes. Industries moved out. The blue collar workers working within those industries have moved out and now have been replaced by white collar workers who are fixing up those particular homes.
Mm. It is such a fascinating area. How long has gentrification been around? I ask that because I've got a funny feeling you're going to say it goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks.
Yes, look, there is some literature out there where it says it goes back to the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans. But in the modern day, if we talk post-World War II, it was first observed by a British sociologist called Ruth Glass back in 1964, where she observed an influx of gentry, that is the affluent and the educated class, buying and renovating the old-style Georgian and Victorian terraces in the West End of London. In Australia, in the 50s and the early 60s, what we had was the motor car made it possible for people to live a relatively long way from the CBD, but still be within driving distance due to the construction of freeways and highways. So some people term that urban sprawl, where our people moved away from the centre of CBDs or even within living CBDs out to the burbs. So as a result, there was an exodus of residents from the city and inner city suburbs as they chased the great Australian dream of living on a quarter acre block. Many of these historic buildings in these city or inner city locations became neglected and derelict. Neglected and derelict historic buildings can be just two of the precursors to gentrification. So, for example, old warehouses were converted to residences in locations in inner city locations such as Collingwood and Abbotsford in Melbourne. And a number of the high-rise commercial buildings in capital cities around Australia were also converted either to apartments or accommodations such as hotels and student accommodation. So the term gentrification was developed only 50 years ago, but as you said before, Tim, yes, some of it does go back to the ancient Greeks and ancient Romans.
You kind of just did this, and this is a question I meant to ask you a couple of minutes ago, because I just wonder if you might be able to break down a little bit more the different stages of gentrification. And I know you've sort of done that in terms of that sort of analysis of, look, we all kind of moved out of the cities, I assume, because they're pretty dreadful places to live when I think of the slums in Surrey Hills and such, and people went out and they yeah. wanted to live in the suburbs. And yeah. then the fashion, the trend has reversed, and now we have decided we all want to live close to the city, even if it means being in a smaller domicile, if you will, and not having that backyard and such. What are the different stages of gentrification? Can you break it down
sure.
a little bit more?
Yeah, so the classic stage model says it begins with the marginal stage, where well-educated but low-income earners such as graduates and the creative class rent and share the unrenovated inner-city dwellings. This then leads to the early stage, where higher-income and cultured professionals move in and buy their homes and renovate so as to enhance their lifestyle. Next, the area is discovered by those with even more money, and some developers and investors buy into the area in the latter stages so they can renovate and sell for profit. And in the final stage, the renovated buildings are put back on the market for sale at prices that the wealthy can afford. So often in gentrification, it'll start with the creative class moving in, so artists, home businesses, because they find offices and places to work in residences at relatively low rents, because not a lot of people in the early stages want to live in these areas because the buildings and the area is not in very good condition. But as slowly the area improves, then the richer people move in because they can afford those higher property values. And as you said earlier, you know, things have changed from the 60s where we wanted the quarter acre block on the outskirts of town. Now many of us want to move closer into town, even if we have to sacrifice space.
What about other cities in the world where this process has gone on? And I suppose we're especially interested when it's caused problems or it hasn't been done well. Are there things to learn from other major cities?
Yeah, look, the two major cities that I can think of and have most been written about are New York and London. So in New York, there are places like Harlem, Brooklyn, the Queens area, and parts of the Bronx, which certainly as I was growing up when we read about these areas or saw them on TV, they were areas that you would not want to walk down late at night. But now, and one of the reasons is due to their proximity to the upclass Manhattan, they are highly sought after locations where property is worth quite a bit. London, places like Soho, Camden, Hackney, many places along the river were industrial and commercial and of low value, as the river back then was just basically a transport route. However, nowadays, waterways all over the world are highly sought after locations for those who can afford to reside there. So certainly in New York, which has been probably the most documented of any of the cities, there has been a lot of protest about this change, but that's mainly been the urban renewal, as we mentioned right at the beginning, because even though the areas might be down and out and the buildings may not be of great quality, they are still people's homes. And in the US, property laws are slightly different to Australia, where in Australia, basically nobody tells you what you can do with your property, assuming that you own it, whereas in the US, it's slightly different. For example, but things are changing. For example, in Sydney or New South Wales, rules are looking to come in where in a block of units, at the moment, you need 100% of the unit owners to agree, for example, to leave so somebody can come in and knock down that block of units and build an even bigger block of units, for example, whereas those rules are looking to be changed so you only need 75% of owners to agree. So 25% of people may be displaced even though they never wanted to move. Whereas overseas, in particular in the US, many people were moved on even though they did not want to move on. So they lost their sense of place. So in the US, especially in the early days, it was done very poorly, but the rest of the world has learnt from those lessons. And now there is a lot more community engagement to help people that are being displaced or relocated.
You listen to ABC Overnights. My name's Tim Brunero. Hi, how you going? We're talking to the property professor, as he's been dubbed, Peter Kalizos. He's talking us through gentrification, how it works and what it might mean for especially the people who are displaced. Have you had this experience? Have you ever lived in a suburb that's been gentrified and you've been chucked out because the rents are too high? Or maybe you want to talk about it from a business point of view. Have you been running a business in an area that has lifted in value and has been gentrified, and that has just meant that you can't afford the rents, and a business you'd built up over many years, you just had to leave it? I mean, there's no other option because the rents went up and someone else could come in and take advantage of your hard work, having worked so hard on that business. Or maybe you've got a positive story to tell about how you've seen a suburb transform with some new money and some new energy. Love to hear from you. What about that commercial space? What do we know about the commercial premises that are part of any suburb?
So what we've got there is generally the older light industrial buildings like warehouses, for example, are deserted because industry work. In the early days, industry needed to be close to the CBD because that's where their markets were. But nowadays, industry is moving out to the outer suburbs because they need to be closer to highways because that's more important. So these old derelict buildings are left to decay, and there'll come a time, there'll come a tipping point where different businesses move in. Now, what you might have in a very large warehouse, you might have a developer might come in and turn that into 10, 20 or 30 different premises so that people can start up their own little businesses. So it's very rare that you'll have just one person moving into these very large buildings in the inner cities, because even though the rents are relatively low, to rent a large premise like that can be very costly. Another one is where we used to have our little corner shops in our residential suburbs that may have been for blue-collar workers. These are now transformed into residences. So many commercial buildings find a different use. And in the last 20 years, what we've seen a lot of is those commercial buildings or office buildings that were built in the 60s and 70s, now no longer as useful as offices because the air conditioning is not what it should be, the lighting is not what it should be, not very energy efficient. And these are often transformed by developers into either residential apartments or maybe a quest apartments or student accommodation.
Just on the, I'm talking about here plain old, just little shops, a cafe, let's say for example. Yeah. That must be heartbreaking if you're in a suburb like Surrey Hills, you've been plugging away, you're building a cafe up and then the area comes up and you get thrown out because maybe even a major chain comes in and they can afford a higher rent point that you can no longer afford.
Yeah, so what you'll find in gentrifying areas, so far as the commercial businesses are concerned, they do transform because in most cases, people rent that premises. So they don't, you know, they certainly have security of tenure during the lease, but once the lease runs out, well, you know, either the tenant or the landlord can decide to move out. But often if the rents are going up and the existing landlord can't pay those rents, then they move out. Whereas for housing, it's slightly different because in Australia, most of us own our own home. So gentrification for homeowners is quite advantageous because even if you don't do anything to your own home, the fact that everyone else is fixing up their homes in the area lifts the value of your property and increasing the equity and your net wealth. But yes, for sure, commercial businesses do change. Their lifespan may only be 5 or 10 years, depending on the term of the lease.
We haven't quite got to negative gearing yet, but people are gearing up to talk about it because I can see what's coming through on the text line and what's coming through on the phone. We might just quickly talk about that because we haven't and maybe get some of Tom's comments and mix them up with some of your commentary. Tom, you think negative gearing's been a key driver of all this. Is that fair, given we're seeing the same phenomena in other countries?
Well, good morning, fellas. Look, I went to school in Collingwood and in the 70s and near the old Collingwood footy ground, and I watched this unfold as people, speaking in the Melbourne context, ran out to Doncaster and along the New Eastern Freeway and the factories there, the shoe factories and all that sort of thing. The whole area changed, but what I noticed in from mid-80s onwards, and it wasn't just Collingwood, it's been across the board, was the this really, really sped up when negative gearing got going. And, I have some philosophical... I'd be interested to know in Peter's comments and yours too, Tim, about how this is causing the haves and have-nots. And the tax deductions for landlords is breathtaking that it can be allowed, but I'm making a social commentary there, but there are people now that will be completely frozen out of home owning forever, average housing loan being now $350,400. It's big money. I'm just wondering that I think the tax advantages are feeding this issue and speeding it up. And I just wonder where it's all going to end because there's a lot of big boy type of town just play Monopoly in these areas. What do you think, fellas?
A lot of issues in there, Peter.
Yeah, certainly, you know, negative gearing has been the cause of a number of people requiring to move out because of investors coming in, they get huge tax benefits. But so far as gentrification is concerned, generally speaking, the investor or the landlord is going to spend the minimum amount of money on the property, and that's usually on necessary repairs and maintenance. And it's only the investor that can reap the rewards of negative gearing. So negative gearing is when you borrow money for an investment, but the homeowner can't take any advantage of negative gearing. And often the homeowner will often overspend. In other words, they might spend $300,000 on upgrading and extending their home, but they only actually add $200,000 worth of value. And for them, they don't care because to the homeowner, money is not the most important thing. If they finish up with their four bedrooms, brand new kitchen, brand new bathroom, then they're happy. So, yes, I can see that you know, negative gearing has caused people to move out of inner city suburbs because properties have increased in value. But so far as gentrification is concerned, that's mainly driven by the homeowner because they are willing to spend the big bucks on upgrades.
So owner occupiers as opposed to people who are hoping to rent out the property.
That's right. Yeah,
that does seem to make a lot of sense. And I don't know what negative gearing laws are like in other countries, but one assumes that if gentrification is happening there and they don't have negative gearing, then it kind of might tell you that negative gearing is not the main driver.
No. Negative gearing is not the main driver of gentrification. It does cause other issues in property that can keep out first-home buyers, for example, because if you go to an auction, there'll be a mix of people and investors, because they know they can get tax benefits from the borrowing the money, in some cases can afford to bid more than the poor old first-home buyer that doesn't get any tax.
The owner-occupier. Yeah. Tom, final word?
Look, I think there's a lot of benefits because the ambience improves and people plant trees and there's more care because of the atmosphere that's created, which is lovely to see the place improve. I just think it's a very blurry line with negative gearing and public policy. One of the few countries in the world that allow it, and I think it's now such a vested interest issue that if any government attempted to raise it, left or right, because one in seven or eight, if that's the correct figure, are landlords, this will become a huge political issue. But and nobody seems to want to address it or touch it.
Mm, yeah, no, it does seem that way, that it's one of those areas of the tax system. A bit like taxing Microsoft and Google and those big guys. We just don't seem to have an answer. We just can't do it. Mind you, the Italians have just given Apple a huge bill, so maybe there's something in what they've just done. Hey, Tom, nice to talk to you. Thank you. Tom, talking tax there. We're talking gentrification this morning on ABC Overnights. Our guest to talk about gentrification is the so-called property professor, Peter Lizos. Peter, let's move on. I wanted to quickly talk to you about the research you've done on predicting whether an area will undergo gentrification. And what you've tried to do, I believe, and better for you to tell me what you were doing than the other way around, but you were basically looking at predicting whether an area will go under gentrification and how you can do that.
That's right. So, and one of the reasons I did this is because investors and homeowners can make a lot of money if they buy into areas before they gentrify or the early stages of gentrification. So, for example, if you knew that Balmain and Paddington and Collingwood and Richmond in Melbourne were going to gentrify and you bought property there, then you could ride that wave of capital growth without really doing much work. And what I found was four of the key indicators were a decrease in the percentage of people aged 18 years and under, and an increase in the proportion of couples without children. So basically what we've got there is gentrified areas are becoming childless areas. So not so much areas where families, young families are, but it could be more mature families with grown-up kids or people moving in without kids. And the other very interesting point that I found was that there is an increase in the proportion of females working in professional occupations. They were one of the key indicators that an area is gentrifying. Other studies around the world have found that the percentage of professionals increases. So this is like accountants, doctors, lawyers, teachers, and so on. But the research that I did here, based on suburbs in Adelaide, was the proportions specifically of females working in professional occupations.
Let's run through that again. You say you can see, or just run through those three different groups.
Sure.
That you said that you can, if you see the demographic change, that will be an indication that a suburb is undergoing gentrification.
Yep. So it's the decrease in the percentage of people aged 18 years and under, and an increase in the proportion of couples without children. So basically less children living in the area, and also an increase in the proportion of women working in professional occupations.
God, it's
Now,
interesting, isn't it?
the females working in professional occupations, that makes sense because most professional occupations are in the CBD. Most gentrifying areas are close to the CBD or in some places close to the water. So that certainly makes sense. But the fact that there are less children living in the area was quite a surprise because normally you consider families moving into these areas, but the research that I did showed the opposite.
It is very interesting. You're on ABC Overnight, so if you'd like to join in, call 1300 800 222. Gerard has done that. Gerard, you wanted to ask a question about your place in West Perth?
That's right. I think it's happening as I speak. We've got the body corporate, the guy's managing it, and he had a levy. There's 24 units in West Perth, and his levy was quarterly $740 per unit, and he's now just recently made it $1,000 a quarter per unit.
Okay, so what was it before?
$740, and he's now charging $1,000.
When you say he, you mean the body corporate?
Well, there's a fellow I can mention that it's Strata Matters, they're called, and
The managers of the Strata. You're right. Yeah, so it was $750. Now it's $1,000 a quarter.
Yes, and. I mean, you know, just collect the levies and, make sure people are paying and a little bit of stuff like that. And then he's got a special levy for security and fencing. So I've just got a bill. I've got a place in Padbury, but I've just got a bill for $2,500, you know. And I know it's my problem, but I'm not getting any rent because my daughter's there. And she doesn't pay any bills. And, you know, when I've got the second property, you can imagine what sort of Centrelink I get, you know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, now that is a very interesting a situation you find yourself in. Peter, any comments to make on that?
Yeah, look, West Perth is a classic for gentrification because it is right next door to the CBD.
Yes, it is.
Now, do you own one of these units in the Strata Group?
I own it, yeah. I've had it for 20 years.
Okay, so when you say the bloke or the strata managers have increased the strata levy...
By 30%, yeah.
Yeah, my understanding is it's the owners that are part of that strata corporation that'll decide how much the levy should increase by.
That's right. I think there's some collusion going on there. I think some of us need to go to these meetings and have a vote. Strata management mob was sacked, and this is what's going about... being sacked. I just have to get some support and get him booted out because, I mean, how much is he? What, I mean, yeah, you mentioned $1,000 a quarter for 24 units. You know, that's not bad, is it? Just to be managing, you know.
No, that is certainly a lot of money. But and your case is quite common around the country where a lot of the owners of the units don't even bother going to the meeting. So
that's
Your first step is for, not only for you to go to the meeting, but to encourage other people to go to the meeting so that they have a better say in what goes on with their own property. Because in the end, you are the owners.
That's right, because they get their proxies and, we'll fight for you. Yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah. The good news for you is even though your daughter's not paying you any rent, in theory, if the area's being gentrified, at least the value of the property is going up.
Very interesting area. Thanks for your call, Gerard.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because when you do own property, there's all these people who get a taste of it. The real estate agent, the strata managers, everyone seems to get a layer cut in at some point. Peter, I just wondered. I suppose I'm kind of fascinated as to why you're so interested in this area and how you got into it.
Well, a bit like the first caller, Tom. I grew up in a gentrifying area. So I grew up in a suburb called Torrensville in the inner western suburbs of Adelaide, which is only 2 or 3 kilometres from the city. My parents were of Greek descent. A lot of migrants moved into these inner city suburbs because back then they were relatively cheap. And so I've seen my area in particular change from a lot of Greek and Italian migrants' families being raised in those houses on large blocks And now what we're seeing is younger professionals moving in with their young families and updating and extending those homes. And on top of that, you've also got the facilities in the area improving. So, for example, the main road going through my area was known as Henley Beach Road. And back when I was a little boy, the only shops you had on Henley Beach Road was one pizza bar and four fish and chip shops. But now on that one road, we have over 30 restaurants and cafes which are servicing the local area. So there are certainly some big pluses in areas that gentrify, not just so far as residential home values are concerned, but also the amenities in the area can improve because the council can see that things are changing. So they also need to do their bit. They need to fix up the roads, the footpaths, the public spaces, and so the whole area improves, not just the residential.
This is the question that I've been putting off asking you because I think it's probably the one, as soon as you start talking about this area, especially when you talk about having a crystal ball or predicting which areas are going to go, this is the question we all want to hear the answer to because we all like to think that we're a bit ahead of the trend. What are the suburbs in the major cities that you see about to take off that we might want to get in on the ground floor on?
Okay, so if we look at the major capital cities, Sydney, St. Peter's, Tempe, Marrickville, Melbourne, Footscray, West Footscray, Brisbane, Woolloongabba, Adelaide, Torrensville, Theberton, Croydon, and West Croydon. And the common theme amongst these suburbs is they have high concentrations of period or character style homes, or otherwise known as historical homes, and they are relatively close to the city. So they'd be the suburbs that I would be looking at. And that's not to say you can buy in there this year and you can sell next year and make a profit, because gentrification takes a very long time. It can take decades for suburbs to turn from ugly ducklings into graceful swans.
It is entirely possible that tomorrow morning, if it was a regular Saturday, which is not really, I don't think there's many houses open for inspection tomorrow, but I do wonder whether some of those suburbs might get a little bit of a bump. I certainly know that I wrote down St. Peter's, Tempe, Marrickville in Sydney, and you went a bit too fast there, but Footscray in Melbourne, Torrensville in Adelaide, and I think you mentioned one in one suburb in Brizzy as well.
Woolloongabba, yeah.
Woolloongabba, yeah. You're on ABC Local Radio. My name's Tim. How are you going? We're talking to the so-called property professor about gentrification, how it works and what it means. Can you perhaps give us just in really a quick summary of the for and against arguments for gentrification?
Yep. So the big advantage of gentrification is that it's an improvement in the area as the physical environment is upgraded. That's both residential, commercial, and public spaces. The one against is some poor people or businesses are forced to move out of the area because of higher rents. It's not the higher property values, because if you own the property, that's actually an advantage to you. But if you don't own the property and you're renting, then you can be forced out. And in some cases, their home is taken away from them. So gentrification can cause some heated and passionate debate, but most of that is left to more so the urban renewal, which, as we talked about at the beginning of the interview, which is the taking away by the demolition of existing homes, whereas gentrification, you retain and upgrade the existing homes. There are definitely advantages and disadvantages, but in my opinion, there are far more advantages in gentrification than disadvantages.
Let's take some more calls. Neil's in Perth. G'day, Neil.
Hi, Tim. Yeah, Perth's a bit different from the other capitals, I think, mainly because of its age and how slowly it grew to start with. But a lot of Perth, the inner city suburbs like East Perth, for example, that was sort of a really downgrade workers area, and now it's sort of luxury. And, of course, the ABCs are in there. And there's apartments and things overlooking the river. Of course, the river's always worth money. But you've got cities like Fremantle, which virtually died because the council liked heritage and they didn't like people. And now they've suddenly discovered you've got to have people and you can have cruise ships, but they can't go shopping if there's no shops with materials to buy for a cruiser. And the whole of the city is really developing very fast, a lot quicker than most people thought. And we've got a lot of traffic congestion because we don't have enough infrastructure. And those sort of things all cause pressure.
That's a really interesting point. Peter, you touched on this, but how much cost is in this for the taxpayer, and how much does the taxpayer foot the bill for gentrification?
Well, so far as gentrification is concerned, there's not a lot of taxpayer money that goes into it, because it's mainly people that own the property that put their own money or equity into it. However, in urban renewal, where buildings are demolished and poor people are forcibly relocated, then that can cost the taxpayer and the government some money. But in the pure sense of the word, if people are upgrading their own homes, there shouldn't be any...
No, but you mentioned, and Neil there was sort of mentioning upgrades in infrastructure and interactions with local council and how their policies can change how this sort of phenomena flows. And I've noticed this in inner city Sydney, in Redfern and Darlington, these areas, that the council is putting enormous amounts of money into widening footpaths, smartening up, you know, what footpaths are made of. They're not just poured concrete, they're kind of lovely big pavers. They're putting in modern sort of gardens and native plants and such. They have a role to play, or they're part of this process, surely.
Sure, huge, yeah. And the reason the local council can do that is because their income from council rates has increased because property values have increased. So greater income from upgraded properties means they have the money to upgrade the roads and the footpaths and put in trees and park benches and upgrade the public spaces and have improved lighting in what used to be dingy areas but now are highly sought after areas. So there certainly can be a mini economy around gentrification, but generally speaking, councils will only, in theory, will only spend the money that they have. But because of people upgrading their own homes, this actually increases their income from high council rates. And incidentally, state government also benefits, because if your property is worth more, when it comes time to sell, you're paying a greater stamp duty. Or if and this is a lower percentage of people, but if you're an investor in a gentrifying area, then you have to pay land tax. The more your land is worth, the more land tax you pay, therefore increasing the income to the state government. So, yeah, governments certainly like gentrification because it increases their income without them doing that much to improve the cash flow.
Hmm. Let's take some more calls. Elizabeth joins us. Hi, Elizabeth.
Oh, good morning. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Elizabeth.
I think, first of all, I think the word gentrification, as far as the outer suburb is concerned, is gilding the lily in just a tiny bit, because houses, quite lovely houses, are being destroyed, and up goes something three or four stories high with on narrow streets where the traffic is hideous, and they're monstrous things. Now, do you really call that gentrification? I live in the outer suburbs, Moorabbin, Croydon, which is the Maroondah Council and the Yarra Valley Council. And what they're building here, is just they're just so ugly and dwarf all the houses around them with no privacy. Now, do we call that gentrification? Have you looked at the outer suburbs at all when you're doing your survey and when you're looking at the at Melbourne in general, our livability and all that?
Peter?
Elizabeth, I would call that urban renewal because they are getting rid of the original homes, and that is very sad because a lot of the community loses their sense of place, their sense of belonging when those homes are demolished and medium or high-rise apartments or buildings are built. And certainly there are a number of disadvantages in urban renewal, especially if there hasn't been much community consultation. But generally, Elizabeth, gentrification tends to happen closer to the city centre. If you're in Melbourne, places like Collingwood, Abbotsford, Richmond is a classic example, because of its proximity to the city, it does have a high concentration of character homes, or period-style homes, as you call them in Victoria, and they're the ones that people like to upgrade and add value to, rather than spending all of that money on, say, a 1960s or 1970s house, which is what is commonly found in the outer suburbs of our major capital cities around the country. So to answer your question, what you're describing there, Elizabeth, to me, is urban renewal, which is different to gentrification. Urban renewal, get rid of old buildings. Gentrification, maintain and upgrade the original buildings and improve the sense of community.
Could you tell me, I'm sorry to take up so much time, Peter, but could
That's
you
right.
tell me how these decisions are made? They go into VCAT. Now, that's in Victoria. Now, when VCAT make this decision, is that just, they just look at a map and they just say, well, we can put so many people on that much land. Do they ever come out and look at the district? Do you have any idea of how they organise that? I've often wondered how they do that, because you can go to the council and the council will say, no, that's too much in this particular area. And the developer goes to VCAT. They say, oh, yes, you can do that.
Okay. Peter, why don't you answer that?
Sure. Look, around the country, Elizabeth, most state governments have a development plan which is based around transit-orientated development. In very simple terms, they want more people living near transport nodes, whether they're train station, tram stops, bus stops. And that then flows down to local councils, because what they do is they rezone areas. So if you are near a train station and you've got, let's say, a 1,000-square-metre block, you might be able to put 10 new dwellings on that particular block of land, mainly because you are close to the train station. However, if you are in a character part of Melbourne, and this may only be even across the road or the next street, then you may not be able to do anything with that property, and it stays as it is. So a lot of it comes down to the zoning of the area.
Okay. We've only got 1 minute left. I'm going to try and ask you two questions before we go, Peter, and you're going to have to be very quick.
Sure.
Are there any areas that have gentrified that are not in the inner cities?
Not that I have found in Australia nor anywhere else in the world.
So not like areas in the Blue Mountains and such?
No. There may be regional areas. Like there are places in Newcastle, for example, Cooks Hill has gentrified. But Cooks Hill is near the CBD of Newcastle.
Okay. Look, I won't get to that second question. It's a pity. Lovely to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you, Tim.
Peter Kalizos, the so-called property professor. Lovely to have him on. He's from the University of SA. And that's another podcast from the Overnights program on ABC Local Radio. I'm Tim Brunero. Thanks for listening.